are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 20, today we're in Rocamadour.
Well, Francois, we're waiting for the traditional winners' Tour de France press conference down at the press room, not far from Rocamadour. Jonas Vingegaard nearly pulled off a surprise time trial stage win. Not quite, though. He led through the three checkpoints, but faded towards the end. He'd had that little wobble as well on the descent where his back wheel went again. Jumbo-Visma ought to check that back wheel out. I know it was a different back wheel because he was on his time trial bike today, but he was very close to the going off the edge of the road and into the rock on the side. But in the end, Vingegaard second to his teammate Wout van Aert. Jumbo-Visma imperious again.
Yeah, he was in a way the predicted outcome of the race today. We all sort of expected Wout van Aert to win this time around, the way he did it last year in Saint-Emilion. That's what happened. But as you said, you know, Jonas Vingegaard was again really, really impressive until strange corner where gravel is getting very popular among, I mean, Tadej Pogacar, you know, had a taste of gravel in Pyrenees and trying to surprise and to attack Vingegaard in the descent. And today, really, there was a thrill, you know, could tell in the press room when after that, Vingegaard obviously took a much more cautious approach to the end of the time trial, and even eased off completely, you know, on the final stretch when you could tell he was already kind of celebrating as he crossed the line, losing at least 10 seconds there, you know, and while, you know, Wout van Aert was just waiting for him, and they tried, you know, more or less, you know, to kind of shake hands on the after the line for what has been, let's face it, the Jumbo-Visma triumph in this Tour de France.
I drove up to the course just about probably 1500 meters away from here. You could come out of the where the press room is and go up and watch, and it was a downhill section coming past a roundabout, and Van Aert was flying. I mean, noticeably quicker than the likes of Mühlberger and Carlos Verona and some of the other riders that had gone through just a bit earlier. He was almost on Nick Schultz, and by the time I got back to the press room and watched on the TV, he'd passed Nick Schultz, the rider who'd set off in front of him. Very impressive by Wout van Aert. But Vingegaard, I was pretty surprised by what a strong time trial he put together, because, he led through the first, second and third time checks, although van Aert's time gap was coming down, and it was obvious that as he came into the final 5 kilometres, Vingegaard had lost the chance of winning the stage. It wasn't the most thrilling of time trials, really, was it? Because the big four, Vingegaard, Pogacar, Van Aert and Geraint Thomas, it turned out, they kind of rode around, shuffling the pack ever so slightly, the order behind Vingegaard at those time checks. And before that, Mikkel Bjerg set the first of the serious times, and then the world time trial champion, Filippo Ganna, scorched through. But then when Van Aert beat that time, it did look like that would be that for the day. And even though Vingegaard was going great guns, one of the Jumbo-Visma riders was a non-starter today. Nathan van Hooijdonk pulled out for family reasons. Don't know too much more about that at the moment. He is the nephew of former Tour of Flanders winner Edwig van Hooijdonk, of course, and his father Gino was also a pro rider. So, don't know too many more details about that, but clearly very sad that he's got so close to Paris and had to go home and won't get to accompany Vingegaard and his teammates on the Champs-Élysées tomorrow.
The cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens for sponsoring the cycling podcast. They've recently done a survey of some of the athletes, amateur and elite, who have signed up to use the Super Sapiens system of continuous glucose monitoring. And according to that survey, 70% of people say that Super Sapiens has improved their daily food management and eating habits. 61% say Super Sapiens has improved their daily lifestyle or training quality. And 57% say that Super Sapiens has helped reduce the number of times that they bonk or crash or feel low energy while exercising. If you'd like to find out more about Super Sapiens, go to supersapiens.com. My own personal experience was that it prompted me to look at my diet quite significantly and think about how I might lose some weight. And so I have Super Sapiens to thank for kickstarting that process. Roughly a year ago now, that was really when I realised that my waistline was going in the wrong direction. Francois, you're smiling. After my diet over the last couple of days, I need to do some serious correcting to my diet when I get back home. But when you're in the southwest of France, it's very difficult, isn't it? We had a nice lunch at the Presse Buffet today, and I was very pleased to be able to enjoy the Rocamadour cheese, which was as good as I remembered it. It's a lovely soft goat's cheese with a nice, not really a crust on it, but it's got a nice skin on it. And what I hadn't really realised was it's actually best enjoyed very young. It's a young cheese.
Well, with goat cheese, you've got two schools. I mean, you know, you the guys who like them creamy, which was the case today, and I think personally, I think Rocamadour is better that way. Some guys prefer to let them age and eat the kind of rock hard stuff. I mean, the two options are valid. Like you said, today was the soft, smooth sauce. So you know, very young Rocamadour, and yeah, actually, it's. Personally, I like it better. The hot stuff is good with a glass of wine, and we didn't drink wine this lunch. So great. You know, it's nice to remember last year we did the cheese of the day on the Tour de France. We didn't do it this time, but Rocamadour is one of the strongholds of goat cheese and one of the good ones. So go for it if you have a chance.
Yeah, it's definitely up there in the goat's cheese category. It'd probably be in the top 10 of GC of my favourite French cheeses, I would say. Do you have a favourite French cheese, Francois?
There's one I like very much, but it's very extreme. It's one for the cobbles, or it comes from the north of France, and it's called La Boulette d'Avennes. And it's kind of a cone. It's greyish with orange little, shades of orange on top of it. When you cut it, it's kind of rugged. I mean, the flesh is not very smooth. So the flesh is I don't know how to describe it. It's kind of
marbly, I would say.
Marbly is a great term. The taste and the smell of it are extreme. Let's face it. So it could, if you're not into that sort of cheese, don't go for it because it's really, really, smelly and the same. And the taste is can be aggressive. If it's too old or if it's not well kept, it can become a little bit sour and even a little bit acid, like vinegar. But if you keep it well and if you take it at the right time with the right stuff, it's that's at least it's a very, very original cheese. And so if you're into hardcore extreme cheeses, go for Boulette d'Avennes.
What's the orange sort of dust on the outside? Is it some kind of almost a chili powder type thing? Is that what they dip it in?
That's the impression I had at first, but I think that just when it ages and kind of rots, it takes this orange color a little bit. You find the same thing in some of the eastern cheese like Munster, where sometimes the skin of it, the top of it gets a little bit orange. It's in this kind of category. I mean, if you I understand that some people might not like it at all. I used to like soft cheese very much, reblochon, which can be absolutely excellent when it's good. But I've actually stopped eating cow's cheese mostly, because yeah, like you, it's a question of diet, and also my tastes have changed a little bit, evolved, and I'm more into goat's cheese or even, you know, sheep's cheese from the Pyrenees. I like Manchego. I like this sort of things these days. I like, you know, to cut, you know, very, very thin slices of a Spanish queso and with a little bit of marmalade or, you know, or jam on top of it. So yeah, tastes evolve, and I'm into the Spanish stuff now.
Well, there is a Tour de France link to this cheese, because many years ago now, I think 2006 or 2007, when I covered the Tour de France in a camper van with Ed Pickering, our colleague still here on the race, and we'll hear from Ed a bit later on in this episode, but we covered the tour, we travelled in a camper van, so the camper van was our, it was our hotel, it was our press room, and three men in there. It was, you know, it got quite warm at night, and one night we went for a meal over somewhere in the northeast somewhere, it might have been a Compiègne sort of area, and we had this meal, and then the cheese trolley came out, and it was quite an extravagant cheese trolley, all stacked up high, and on the right on the very top was this pointy cheese, which Madame called Le Volcan, the volcano, and it was with this sort of orangey fiery dust on it, or mold, or whatever it was. And of course, being idiots, we didn't heed her warning, and we had a big chunk of this cheese, and my word, it made the sort of tear ducts well up. You could feel it in your tonsils almost. You could certainly feel it going all the way down. It was a really, really strong flavour. But that was nothing compared to how the flavour matured overnight. You could smell it on your skin the next day, this incredible, pungent cheese. And I'd never known what it actually was until last night. And we were having this conversation about cheese, Francois, and you said, oh, Boulette d'Avennes, and you described it. And I was like, that might be it. And so I Googled it, and sure enough, finally, I know the name, the actual name of Le Volcan, so I know what to avoid next time.
Well, it's actually, that's a recipe I used to go to a restaurant. I was a student in Lille, and one of the recipes was pork chop avenoise, which means melted boulette d'Avennes on top of it. So not very kosher at all. And when the waiter came from the kitchen into the room, and, you know, and went to your table with that dish, I mean, the smell was absolutely outrageous. Everybody was watching what you were having, and it was really, you know, you were kind of the star of the show with that disgusting dish coming your way. But there you are, you know.
10, counter 10, Nick Schultz, 21st fastest time, 41 seconds a lift. Kilometre 22, Danny Martinez, 9e temps, à 35 secondes, 35 secondes.
Well, let's just talk a bit more about the time trial before we go in and see the winners' press conference. The top three on GC traditionally come into the press room after the penultimate stage. But yeah, Wout van Aert, another time trial win for him in the Tour de France, and possibly this quartet of Jumbo-Visma stage wins to round off the Tour de France. It's very much on, isn't it? If van Aert or Laporte, they have two live options for the Champs-Élysées tomorrow. Vingegaard, in the end, convincing. I mean, 19 seconds behind van Aert, but as you say, quite a chunk of that was just in him kind of sitting up and enjoying the moment as he came home. Pogacar, solid ride, 27 seconds down, and Geraint Thomas, really, really good finish to an excellent tour for him at 32 seconds, 10 seconds quicker than the world time trial champion Ganna, who was the fifth of five riders to average over 50 kilometres an hour for, you know, a lumpy-ish course with that climb at the end, of course. After them came Bauke Mollema, Mattia Cattaneo, Fred Wright of Bahrain Victorious. That's a very, very good ride by him. 1 minute 32 down on van Aert, but after his you know, the leg testing break yesterday, that bodes well for his future. Then Max Schachmann of Bora Hansgrohe, and another Bahrain Victorious rider like Fred Wright, Jan Tratnik in 10th, and I suppose Stefan Kung 11th, you know, a specialist time trialist, but that today was really a grand tour, end of a grand tour, end of a long hot Tour de France type time trial. When you see the GC riders, they're the strongest men in the race, and it comes down to strength and endurance more than it does the sort of time trial specialism.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can tell those jerseys kind of, as you say, transcend them. They really go for it. They have a kind of magic effect on the riders. Well, very good overall performance by the French today. I mean, Romain Bardet for many years, you know, really lost it in time trials. And remember 2017 when he in Marseille when he lost second place to Rigoberto Urán thanks to his poor time trial. And he's improved considerably and managed, if I'm not wrong, to overtake Luis Meintjes overall to settle in seventh place. And David Godu is not a time trial expert either, but another solid performance, and he kind of strengthened or at least comforted his fourth place. Well, you know, there's something there, maybe for the future. But yeah, as you said, you know, there was a little bit of a shake-up in the GC, but minor one with Nairo Quintana and Luis Meintjes losing a little bit of ground, I think, on Andrei Lutsenko and Bardet coming over Luis Meintjes. Yeah, experience there. You know, mattered a lot. But once again, those last time trials of a Grand Tour, you never get the results you would have at a World Championship at all. And once again, I mean, Wout van Aert, what can you say, you know? We'll wait for tomorrow to see whether he can, well, he did it last year, you know, win the time trial and back-to-back win the final sprint in the Champs-Élysées. If he did, I mean, the performance by Jumbo-Visma with seven wins, I mean, now they've equaled the best performance since of Team Sky in 2012, who had six stage wins. If Van Aert win, or Laporte, as you said, win tomorrow on the Champs-Élysées with seven wins, it will be the best overall team results since 1984 and Renault Gitane. So yeah, I mean, what can we say? Flawless performance by Jumbo-Visma, and we can really not see any reason why it shouldn't go on until the end in Paris.
Yeah, let's not downplay how well David Godu rode today, because although he did have a little buffer, he still did a very good time trial, finished 26th, and we have seen him blow up a bit in time trials before, so he'll be very pleased with that fourth place. And then, as we kind of highlighted yesterday, positions 5 to 8 were really rife for a shake-up, and that's what happened, because Alexander Vlasov leapt up from 7th to 5th, Nairo Quintana went down one, Romain Bardet went up one, and Luis Meintjes, as he said, Francois, went down from 6th to 8th. So he equals his best Tour de France GC finish, Meintjes, but doesn't beat it. Alexei Lutsenko and Adam Yates round out the top 10. The time gaps, though, significant, aren't they? I mean, 10th place, Adam Yates, 25 minutes down. I mean, that's not necessarily unusual, but it's very much been the top two, then Thomas, and then Godu, and then kind of the best of the rest. And I think today the time trial would sort of back that up, really.
Yeah, and I mean, it just, you know, confirmed what we saw in the mountains. Once again, when we first saw Tadej Pogacar fade, you know, and wane a little bit on Granon, it was so unexpected that we asked ourselves what was wrong. But in every stage that mattered, Vingegaard was the best man. What better than Pogacar? Even today, you know, obviously, well, maybe Pogacar had lost his morale a little bit, you know, and he settled for that second place and didn't have the motivation to really go for it, because there was absolutely no chance of overtaking or toppling Vingegaard off the. But yeah, the outcome is pretty logical. I mean, really, Vingegaard from the start in Denmark till the finish in Rocamadour was simply the better man. And you know, sometimes we've seen, of course, this spectacular like changes at the last minute, like we had in 2020 when Pogacar beat Roglic, but they're very rare. And I don't know what to say, because I mean it was really a kind of a textbook performance by Jumbo Visma, with a few little thrills and hiccups here and there, but really in the end, yeah, the hierarchy was really confirmed today. And as you said, very, very impressed by the maybe the most consistent, like, you know, with his with his familiar wide classes, you know, going his own way and riding through France, you know, looking at the podium. I mean, Geraint Thomas at the age of 36 rode a sensational Tour de France. He has now been on the three spots of the podium. I mean, it's not a career crowning, because I mean he won the Tour de Suisse and he's probably got more you know in his legs. But once again, I mean, if anybody had doubts about Geraint Thomas, you know, GC and Grand Tour abilities, I mean, his record speaks for itself.
Well, let's go back into the press room and wait for the top three. Earlier on today, I spoke to some friends of the Cycling Podcast from the press room just to get their thoughts on the Tour de France in general. First up, this is our friend Ciro Scognamiglio, cycling writer for the big Italian newspaper La Gazzetta dello Sport. Ciro, if I may say so, that is a very nice Hawaiian-style shirt. Very bright orange with some very vivid flowers. You've got a fuchsia flower and some bright green leaves. You look like you're dressed for holidays.
Yes, it's exactly, dear listeners. I bought this in Rio de Janeiro, where I was not for the Olympics, obviously, but for holidays. And I'm preparing for the stage number 22 on Monday, the only stage that I can win. You already know this.
No win for Italy today. Filippo Ganna, well, no answer to Wout van Aert.
I mean, Wout van Aert is, in my opinion, by far the best rider of this Tour de France. I don't think that also the performance of Jonas Vingegaard or Tadej Pogacar, well, certainly Vingegaard will win the Tour, Tadej Pogacar will be second, but concerning the performance, you know, in basketball, NBA, they use this kind of world most valuable player, MVP. I think that Wout van Aert can be considered the MVP of this tour.
WVA is the MVP. Yeah, I think I agree with you there. What's the mood about Italian cycling, though? We talked a bit about this during the Giro, didn't we? Not a lot to cheer about here.
Well, we already knew this, and also the Giro has been disappointing also because Vincenzo Nibali arrived fourth, but he is almost 38 and he will retire at the end of the season. We already knew this. The big problem, in my opinion, for Italian cycling is that we don't have a man that can take the legacy of Vincenzo Nibali for the Grand Tour. Not this year, not next year, but I don't see an Italian rider competing for the victory of a Grand Tour in the next 5, 6, 7 years. I must confess, I have to say honestly this. For concerning the other things, it's true, no stage victories for Italy, but we need maybe a special edition of the podcast only to speak about this. Maybe, I don't know, an evening in London, dear listeners, my dream, as we had some years ago in Foilers in Tottenham Court Road, because certainly Italy no stage victory. The last one in Tour was Vincenzo Nibali in 2019, but for example, Spain, the last one was in 2019, Omar Fraile in Mand. French guys, only 2 stage victories in 2 years in the Tour. Alaphilippe, the first one of last year, and Laporte yesterday. So, I mean, let's talk about Belgium. Belgium in these last years, they had a great champions. For example, Bonen, Gilbert, and now Evenepoel and Wout van Aert is amazing. But we have to remember that this last Belgian winner of Grand Tour, we have to come back to 70 years. I mean, the era of Van Imp. So, I mean, it's complicated. The analysis, the cycling is spreading. I mean, the number of nations that are competitive at high level is increasing year by year, and so for traditional nations, it's becoming always more difficult.
What about UAE Team Emirates then? Because that team has the kind of the heart of Lamprey, really, still. No, it kind of evolved from an Italian team, still has some key Italian staff. But of course, Andre Hauptmann, Tadej Pogacar. Why is a team like that not scouting, looking for the next big Italian riders? Or maybe they are and it's just too soon.
Yes, it's true. It's not the only team that have an important, for example, Italian members, not only as rider, but also in the staff, for example, also Astana, but also Ineos Grenadiers, for example. I mean, as sport directors that are Italian, Cioni, Tosato, Mechanics, Suaniers. Concerning UAE, I think that... that certainly they are looking for the next big Italian thing in cycling, but I don't see this, as I told you, in the horizon. So it's also difficult to find, to scout, because in my opinion, so far doesn't exist. For example, we talked about Spain. Spain, for example, has Ayuso and Rodriguez. They are normally in perspective really strong. I don't see at the same age Italians so strong, unfortunately.
What do you think of Vingegaard and Pogacar's battle this year? Because I thought Pogacar would be very, very difficult to beat, but he's had two wobbles and Vingegaard has capitalised on those wobbles and won convincingly, really, in the end.
Well, certainly before the start of the tour, my bet was Pogacar. I must confess this. But their battle has been really, really impressive. In my opinion, the level of performance in this Tour de France has been the highest in the last period. I covering Tour de France starting on road, I mean, till 2007, more or less, so 15 years. In the last period, this year, has had the most impressive level. And certainly Vingegaard deserved the victory. And I think that this can be a kind of battle also in the future, because Pogacar is only 23, Vingegaard only 25. It's not the first time that they share first and second place in a race. Obviously, last year in the Tour de France, but for example, also in Tirreno Adriatico of this year, Pogacar arrived first, Vingegaard arrived second. So can be a kind of duel as we saw in the past, for example, as Contador and Schleck, but also for more years, in my opinion.
Why do you think the level has been so high this year? I mean, I've got some thoughts about the way the course has been, quite a lot of short stages. There hasn't been the days when everyone is a bit frightened of the parkour, maybe. But the racing has gone from kilometre zero nearly every day.
Several reasons. In my opinion, now every team arrives at the Tour de France with the preparation, not 100, but 110%. And in the Tour de France, more and more in the years, everything counts. Not only the victory, not only the second or the third place, but also the other classifications. I don't want to speak only about the results, but the things that impressed me maybe more in this Tour de France. Guys, for example, as Michael Morkov, guys as Marc Soler, they arrived outside time limit, but they want to arrive at the finish. Jakobsen, really, for example, for 16 seconds, he arrived at, he was able to finish stage in the Pyrenees. But also Geschke, he cried when he lost his Polka Dot jersey. So in my opinion, these images can explain better than any other words why is the Tour is so important and why the level has been so high.
And what will you do for stage 22?
Dear listeners, certainly you can imagine not mountains. On Monday in Milan, I must confess that the very stage number 22 for me will be on Thursday, because on Thursday we'll start two week period of holidays, you can imagine where, you can imagine which kind of holidays. But I can assure you, dear listeners, if in these holidays I see by chance a cyclist, maybe cross my road, I change my direction. This is for sure.
Well, enjoy your holiday, Ciro. You've earned it.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, our long-term sponsors. They've been with us since, I think, 2016. I could be wrong. It could even be 2015. It's a long time now, and we're very grateful for their continued support. And for a long time, they've also been passing on a 25% discount to all Cycling Podcast listeners. Go to scienceinsport.com and use the discount code SISCP25 and stock up on everything you need to fuel your ride. Not just during your ride, but also before and afterwards to make sure that you're in tip-top condition for your training or racing. That's SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. This is Edward Pickering. My good friend and colleague, we first covered the tour together for Cycle Sport magazine back in 2006, I think it was. Certainly 2006, 2007, as I said, we shared a camper van on and off during those tours. And he enjoyed the Boulette d'Avenne as well. And, well, this is his impressions of the Tour de France. These days, of course, he is the editor of Rouleur magazine. And before that, he was editor of Pro Cycling. So, very experienced cycling journalist, and we had a chat about the tour in general. What's your main takeaway on the tour, Ed? Because it has been a race where it was very exciting and it was in the balance, and then all of a sudden it wasn't in the balance at all.
No, you're right, actually. I think that it's been an exciting tour. I'm not just saying that because I'm an excitable person about cycling. I'm not afraid to say if the tour has been boring. For example, last year I found the tour below averagely exciting. This year it's been exciting to watch. I think there's been quite a lot of variety, quite a lot of surprises, quite a lot of aggression, a lot of attacking. And through the race, I felt that there was a lot of jeopardy in the yellow jersey battle. Even after the Col du Granon, every day I was waiting to see what Pogacar was going to do, and it seemed like it could be, you know, a close race. And then in retrospect, as soon as they pretty much started the last climb up to Hautacam, I realised that the GC battle hadn't been that, you know, there hadn't been that much jeopardy, and that Vingegaard was always going to win. So I've got, it's a funny mix of not much dynamism in retrospect in the yellow jersey competition after the Col du Granon, mixed with really some quite innovative and exciting stage battles. And I'm thinking of, you know, Wout van Aert's win in Calais was unusual because that, you know, I think most years up to this year, that would have been a sprint. Maybe a Julien Alaphilippe in the last couple of years could have done the same, but I think that was a sprint stage, and he won it in quite an unusual way. Then you carry on through, you know, the cobbled stage is always very dynamic. The middle mountain stages, you know, in the Vosges and the Alps were, you know, they were quite exciting because the race was still quite close at those points. And I think Bobby Jungels was attacking a long way out. The main GC stage, the only real kind of meaningful GC stage in retrospect, the Col du Granon was brilliant. And then we had things like, you know, Michael Matthews winning at Mond, which I think still remains my, probably with the Col du Granon, my favourite stage of this tour. So every day there's been something exciting and compelling. So on a day-to-day basis, I've really enjoyed this tour. And then looking back over the GC battle, I think really there was one important day and the rest was kind of a phony war. It kind of reminded me of the Giro this year in reverse, where it was very, very close all the way through to that one crucial stage. This time the crucial stage came early and then it seemed like there was a battle, but maybe there wasn't. Obviously the riders still have to ride through and the race happened, but in retrospect you can say of this tour, the strongest rider won, second strongest rider was second, third strongest rider third, fourth strongest fourth. behind that, I mean, and yeah, I'd not seen the result of the time trial. We're speaking before the end of the time trial, so I'm not going to go any further than that. And Godu Mill still might have a shocker.
Well, that's a relief, because the general idea of the general classification is that it sorts the riders into the order of how strong they've been over 3 weeks. So, perfect.
No, this is the thing about cycling, that cycling is about who the strongest is, but the really good thing about cycling is that people can make it, teams can make it, and individuals can make it so that the strongest rider doesn't win. And you could even argue that if the Col du Granon hadn't happened the way it did, Pogacar might have been the strongest. He looked a little bit stronger than Vingegaard in the run-up to that stage. But Vingegaard and Jumbo-Visma, I think they beat him psychologically rather than physically. The physical battle was as close as anything. The two strongest riders are up there, but you know, the difference in the end, which totally negates what I just told you 2 minutes ago, the difference was that one stage where there was an element of gamesmanship, of drawing Pogacar out, and the thing I think they did against him, they used his strength against him.
Our listeners love football analogies, so I'll give a football analogy, but it was like two very well-matched teams, but Pogacar found himself chasing the match, 2-0 down. If it had been level, you know, 0-0, I think what you're saying about the psychological battle, that's where he got undone, really, because he had just too much to make up. If it had been closer, he could have taken more risks. He probably, you know, might have landed a blow or two, and the psychological doubt might have been with Vingegaard instead of with Pogacar. So I think, yeah, he was in a position where he had to try and force things to happen, and he couldn't do it going up. He tried to do it going down and came a bit of a cropper. The other theme for me from this tour is that there really hasn't been any crumbs left for the smaller teams. I mean, the smaller teams have really not had any great opportunities to... They haven't even really been allowed to shape the brakes and get up the road much, because the identity of the riders in the break, especially over the second half of the race, it's been powerhouse riders day after day. Even yesterday's doomed break was basically five of the best rouleurs in the world being given a minute and 50 seconds, and that was it.
Yep, there's nothing left for the weaker riders anymore. That's it. I agree with you to an extent. I mean, when you look at... Well, it's clear that UAE and Jumbo-Visma and Ineos, I think, they've been the best, they've been the strongest, they've had the most strength in depth, they've controlled the racing. That said, a couple of teams have punched above their weight. I think EF, Easy Post, you know, they got their stage win. Israel Premier Tech got two stage wins, and on decent, you know, hard stages. And you know, a few teams have come away with stage wins, but they've kind of rescued their tour with that. You know, that, like I said, there have been slim pickings. The last two mountain stages were won by Pogacar and Vingegaard. In the Col du Granon stage, Vingegaard won. The breaks just don't really get minutes and minutes anymore. Even yesterday, I can't remember what it peaked out at, because I was having a slight doze in the press room, but it wasn't much above a minute. When you think a minute, you know, in the past, they used to leave it till 10K to go to, you know, bring them back to a minute. And these days, like 80K to go, they'll be controlling it in a minute. And yeah, it's the dynamics change. And I guess the tour's so important that they don't risk, you know, the break being successful. But yeah, apart from those top teams, when you look at, you know, Astana, Lotto, B&B hotels, even teams like Bora, and, you know, Cofidis haven't come away with much. I mean, Cofidis almost came away with a climber's jersey, which they actually probably deserved in my opinion, but they've come away with nothing apart from a few days on the podium. All those teams, yeah, there's not been much for them. You're right. I mean, the tour has been kind of moving towards a situation where there are the haves and the have-nots, and you'll get just a couple of teams just nicking a stage win here and there, and that seems to be the story of the modern tour.
The theme for me has been the intensity, and I do wonder now, everyone knows now that the race is broadcast from kilometre zero to the end. There's literally nowhere to hide anymore, and although maybe the viewing figures aren't huge on a midweek afternoon at the first 50k or so, I do wonder whether the combination of shorter stages, the fact it's all on television, there's not a minute of the race that doesn't matter anymore. There really isn't. There's no kind of downtime. There's not even been one of those sort of unofficial truce type stages this year.
No, maybe the second and third stages in Denmark. It's just a little bit more relaxed, which is funny, but at the same time, more relaxed in terms of letting the brake go straight away. But you know, it was tense. There were crashes. The roads were narrow, and it was still very intense. But you're right. Sometimes the brake has been taking 60 or 70 kilometres to go, and that's full on racing for, you know, an hour and a half at the start of the stage, and that's got to take a physical toll, and you can see it. And I think one of the effects that this has is that the GC gets fairly set, and we're kind of waiting for Pogacar to do a big kind of Hail Mary in the Pyrenees, but I don't think he can. I don't think his team is up to it, and I don't think he's up to it, because you know the racing's been intense. It's been a hot tour as well, and there's just not that lull that you used to get, you know, on quite a few days during the tour or during the transition stages. You know, those three stages in the Massif Central between the Alps and the Pyrenees this year, I remember even maybe 10 years ago, those, or 15 years ago, those would have all been day for the break, GC riders sit up and kind of trundle in 15 minutes behind a bunch of guys. And now it's just not like that. The break is racing intensely to get away, keeping a gap of 5 or 6 minutes tops, and then they have to race for the win, and then the GC riders start kicking off a little bit, or their teams start kicking off a little bit at the end of those stages as well. So apart from Denmark, maybe, it's been full on every day, and they must all be shattered.
And what about Vingegaard? Because, well, somebody made the point on our podcast, I can't remember who it was, it might have been Francois, it might actually have been Dan Martin. It was a good point, so it certainly wasn't me. In 2019, we thought, well, that's it. We're in the Egan Bernal era now. Everyone's living in his world. Then it was, well, Pogacar, everyone's basically trying to, you know, just hang on to his coattails. Vingegaard has looked really, really good. But is he a kind of, you know, is he going to back up? Is he going to be a multiple tour winner? Or will Pogacar kind of reassert his superiority next year? I know I generally don't like speculation, but it does feel a little bit like the good point that was made was that this intensity of the racing, is it leading to kind of shorter eras at the top for riders and more of a kind of turnover of stars?
It's a good question. We don't know what's going to happen, because one thing I do think about this tour is that Pogacar was a little bit found out. In the past, he used to go for long attacks. Everyone was kind of so intimidated and scared by it that maybe they just assumed they were racing for second, whereas this year the race was taken to him. He spent a lot of the first 10 days making little efforts here and there, and at the time we all thought, well, it's Pogacar doing Pogacar stuff. Turned out maybe he might have been tiring himself out, and now he's kind of, I think he might have lost his element of surprise. Now when he attacks from a long way out, like he did in the Pyrenean stage, or tried to, people are following him and it's closing him down. He did, you know, did the same maybe on the Alpe d'Huez stage. Maybe he's been found out. But then again, you know, you can see objectively he's so physically talented and geared towards these kinds of races that, you know, yeah, he won't tail off. I don't think his morale will go. I think he's got an optimistic predisposition, and that's going to mean that he's going to come back. He might try and rein in the constant attacking, and which might be to his benefit. If his goal is to win lots and lots of Tours de France, then if he reins in and bases, you know, just follows Pogacar around, Vingegaard around for 2 weeks and does one big attack, then physically, maybe that's the way to do it. So don't think Pogacar's finished. On the other hand, Vingegaard, I'm still getting to know him, and I think he's still quite enigmatic as a human being. As a racer, he's obviously very good, because he was second best of the rest last year. I know there were extenuating circumstances, you know, a lot of riders crashed out, but
that's the tour.
Yeah, the riders who finished the race, you know, that's the order they finish in, and he deserved his second place. Didn't really have an off day last year. I think he probably didn't follow Pogacar in the Alps. He didn't feel, you know, that was his place, and he was, you know, everyone was so intimidated, so maybe bought into that. But second last year without really having any big off days. This year he hasn't shown one, I don't think he's shown a single weakness. I've not looked at him and thought he's vulnerable a single time, and it's why I felt quite early on between the Alps and Pyrenees that he had Pogacar's measure, just because, yeah, he just showed no weakness. On the other hand, something about, especially multiple tour winners, there's a kind of charisma that they have, and it's unique to each one. They all have different, you know, it's not like you have to have a certain set of personality traits to win the Tour de France multiple times. But they've each got their own charisma. Like Froome was kind of aloof and diffident and, you know, rode in, you know, in an indestructible manner when he was on the bike and kind of had that intimidating team. And that was his tour-winning charisma. When you think of someone like, you know, Armstrong, obviously he's been stripped of his titles, but when he was, in inverted commas, winning all those tours, he had a kind of reign of fear, of intimidation. Indurain was the kind of, was quiet, placid, but again, showed no emotion whatsoever. And all those riders had charisma of a certain kind of rubber, which kind of reinforced their racing ability. And with Vingegaard, I just don't know what that is with him. I mean, he's very good at racing his bike, we can tell that, but, you know, he's not really shown anything else. And it might be that he's still, even towards the last few stages of this year's tour, he's kind of been eclipsed a bit in terms of column inches by Pogacar, because we've been waiting for him to do something. We're still all talking and thinking about him. Suddenly, I'm turning my attention to Vingegaard and kind of wondering what he's like and how he'll assert himself in the future, because he was the underdog going in this year, and that suits him very well. Next year, that won't be the case. All eyes will be on him, and I'm trying to work out how he'll deal with that and what his kind of tour-winning charisma is.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. What is his kind of superpower away from the actual racing ability? He doesn't look like a particularly intimidating character, other than a kind of a limpet-like ability to react as soon as Pogacar did anything. Vingegaard just did not wait. There was barely a moment's hesitation in the tour. Just a thought that occurred to me about Pogacar is, you know, he was like the kind of the kid at school who was brilliant at absolutely everything, and, you know, then another child joins the school from another school and turns out to be slightly better, and it sort of maybe will shock him into, you know, perhaps he didn't, you know, he's so used to perhaps not having to get into the, you know, the very, very top gear that often, that he didn't quite know how to find it, and that he maybe needs to just go away and work out how to meet a challenge that is every bit his equal for next year. I mean, it must be strange, particularly the manner he won last year, to come up against, you know, a much, much firmer challenge and find that when he wanted it, it wasn't quite there.
No, but that is also, I think, to do with the racing style he had this year. You know, he attacked over the cobbles, and he obviously sprinted to win stages 6 and 7. Those efforts are worthwhile. However, he was sprinting for the line in the middle mountain stages into the Alps, and then I started thinking he was actually being a bit showy and a bit complacent, because at that point he wasn't 5 minutes clear of Vingegaard. He was like 39 seconds or something. So I think he's been undone by that. And I don't think he would have to change much at all to be extremely convincing rival to Vingegaard next year. And also, you know, the tables have turned. Everyone based their race around Pogacar this year. Next year, everyone's going to base their race around Vingegaard. And everyone's going to be watching him. He's not going to have the element of surprise. When he starts mucking around on the Col du Glibier next year on Route de Granon, maybe people will be wise to that. So, you know, you always, even as a multiple tour winner, you have to keep finding new ways of winning the tour. I mean, Indurain never did, actually, to be fair. But that's not even true. I was trying to kind of be facetious there. But Indurain developed from a time trialist. He started winning mountain stages in 94 and 95. So you have to keep discovering new ways of winning the Tour de France. And Pogacar kind of managed that. 2020 was very different from the way he won it in 2021. And he tried to win it in a different way this year, even by not even waiting for the mountains to start attacking. And it came around and bit him on the backside. Vingegaard, I haven't seen that he will have another method. I mean, people will be waiting for what he did this year and basing their race off it. And it will change the dynamic.
And finally, this is Hans Rugenberg, Dutch journalist who's had a very busy 3 weeks, because although a Dutch rider isn't top of the general classification, Jumbo-Visma is very much a Dutch team. And, well, there may well be an all-Dutch finale on the Champs-Élysées tomorrow if Fabio Jakobsen can summon up some strength from somewhere, or Dylan Groenewegen perhaps sprint it out on the Champs-Élysées. Hans, it looks like the first Dutch team to win the Tour de France since TI Rally, Joep Zoetemelk in 1980. But how is this story going down in the Netherlands? Do cycling fans in the Netherlands and sports fans in general, do they see Jumbo-Visma as almost the Dutch team, even though the riders in the yellow and green and polka dot jerseys are not Dutch riders?
Well, of course, it would be better for the Dutch fans if there was a Dutch competitor as well, like Dumoulin a few years ago, of course, when he was second in the Tour de France. But I can see that it gets more and more in the people's head that this team is doing very well because, yeah, they're kind of crushing this Tour de France, of course. So I see it in the figures that that they read stories more and everything. So yeah, it's beginning to live a little bit more now, yeah, in the Netherlands.
Obviously, the team's Dutch rider Steven Kruiswijk had a really unfortunate end to the tour, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, he had some problems with his collarbone. I think he broke it, and also there was something with his shoulder as well. So, yeah, that's a pity because he was the only Dutch rider in this team, of course. So, yeah, people can identify a little bit with him, of course, and he was doing well. Eh? He was riding in front at the mountain. So, there was something that the people in Holland could see as, hey, we've got a Dutch guy. But if you see Alpe d'Huez with the Dutch corner, of course, with so many Dutch people, and also along this road, which very much Dutch people are having their holidays here. Yeah, they kind of still are enjoying it, as I can see.
What about Jumbo, the supermarket chain? Because it's a supermarket chain competing with Gulf states, UAE, Astana, the Kazakh state, Bahrain, another Gulf state, a billionaire, Jim Ratcliffe and Ineos. And Jumbo is a supermarket, a big supermarket, because they have branches all across Europe, don't they? But do you get the sense that of the profile of the Jumbo supermarket being boosted by the success of the cycling team?
I think that's kind of difficult because we have different kind of supermarkets like in every country, of course. But, well, if you see Jumbo on television, I don't think you're going to do more groceries over there if you're going to another store. I don't think so. But still, for the other countries where Jumbo is new, they're trying to get up more in Belgium. Well, if you got Van Aert in the team, that's a good thing, of course. But I don't think in the Netherlands that people will say now, well, we now go to Jumbo to do our shoppings.
Where do you do your shopping, Hans?
I must confess, I do it at Albert Heijn. But that's because it's near my house. Because if there was a Jumbo or another store, I would go there. So,
I mean, the team obviously is competing with these huge, companies and countries that have a lot of backing. Yeah. But this story, this journey, really, Jumbo-Visma, the team salvaged from the wreckage of Rabobank, and then there was the kind of the interim period, the wilderness years, or where they had no sponsor. They were Blanco for a while, and Belkin, and now they've really re-established themselves, and they set out with this goal to try and challenge Team Sky, and now here we are. They've achieved their goal of winning the yellow and the green jersey.
Yeah, and the polka dot as well, as I must say. Yeah, they had a really difficult time, like you said, after Rabobank stopped in 2012. It was really difficult, and they were on the corner of maybe quit. But then, yeah, they stood up and they tried to get up a new team. And if you see them now, it's unbelievable because they're the best team in the Tour de France without a doubt. And I think a lot goes to Richard Plugge, who is the manager of the team, but also Marijn Zeeman and all those people who built Jumbo-Visma, like they are now.
And what about the other big story for Dutch cycling, the rivalry between Dylan Groenewegen and Fabio Jakobsen? Of course, we all remember the crash in the Tour of Poland. There was something quite symbolic about the fact they both won a stage in Denmark, and they may well go head-to-head again on the Champs-Élysées tomorrow.
Yeah, maybe, but if I saw Jakobsen yesterday, I think it will be difficult for him. But let's hope they will be facing each other over there, because in the first two stages there wasn't really a man-to-man fight between them. And it will be nice to see after this horror crash in Poland 2 years ago, and after what they did in the first weekend of the tour, winning first Jakobsen and then Groenewegen, to see them against each other. Yeah, and on the Champs-Élysées, the winner of those two could be the fastest sprinter in the world.
Jakobsen's on his last legs, though, really, isn't he? I mean, he only just made the time cut a few days ago, still struggling on the climbs. The whole Quick-Step team is with him on the final big Pyrenean stage. But somehow the sprinters find their legs, don't they? Even though they're completely finished when it comes to the climbs, there's something about the finish line on the Champs-Élysées that kind of rejuvenates them.
Yeah, that we've seen in the past already. The sprinters, then when they smell the finish line in Paris, they can do something more. But what I see in this Tour de France, it's the fastest Tour de France in history. And yesterday we saw also the sprinters were all... They were finished because, well, when Laporte won and he came in front, I never seen something like that before, that the sprinters teams couldn't get a rider like that back. So hopefully we're going to see a sprint on the Champs-Élysées. But like, but Jakob said, yeah, but it's still quite steep onto the Champs-Élysées every time. And he was afraid of that. I never heard a sprinter talk like that, because when sprinters say something like that, then you know it's been a hard tour for everyone, and for the sprinters even more, I think.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Well, Francois, the sound of the Tour de France packing up behind us, everything has to move north to Paris. We've got a...
Well, here we are. The signal to, you know, of the big exodus to Paris. Yeah, everybody's packing up. You can tell people, you know, trying to find the right way to get to Paris. Some are sleeping in Limoges, others are sleeping here, others are really going all the way to Paris tonight. And it's funny because we say that every year, but once again, the last stage will be one for the sprinters, and there'll be lots of show on the Champs-Élysées. But yes, yeah, normally it's a lap of honour for Jonas Vingegaard.
Unnecessary honking from this truck here, I think. I don't know what he's trying to tell somebody. Is it? We're not in the way, are we? No, I don't think so. Well, we saw the press conference of the top three riders, Geraint Thomas, Tadej Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard. And we'll talk about the GC battle a bit more tomorrow in Paris, Francois. But let's just hear a little bit from Jonas Vingegaard in his winner's press conference. I know there's still one day to go, but effectively, he's the winner of the Tour de France. This is Jonas Vingegaard talking to the media in the press room, probably about an hour and a half after the stage finish. And, well, one of the questions was from Kate Wagner, who made the point that Vingegaard had not really faced the same questions about doping that Tadej Pogacar faced last year. And, well, this is what Vingegaard had to say about that.
We are totally clean, every one of us. I can say that to every one of you. No one of us is taking anything illegal. I think why we are so good is the preparation we do. Yeah, we take... Yeah, altitude camps to the next step. We do everything in with materials, with everything, with food, with training. I think the team is really the best within this. That's why you have to trust us. I knew from last year that I had the level to compete for the victory, but then still to take it is something different, and it's just been really incredible. I always believed that I had a chance of winning the Tour de France, but now to actually do it is it's really incredible.
It was a fair point from Kate that in the press conference, Vingegaard has not faced the same kind of questioning that we've seen from riders in the yellow jersey in the past.
Yeah, it was one of the astonishing points for me. Like you had the impression our colleagues and maybe cycling had kind of turned the page, and then doping was no longer an issue, was not interesting for our colleagues. Maybe because the race was exciting, there was a bit of a battle, and probably the questions crop up more easily when there's a real solid domination by just one rider from start to finish. So with the battle between Vingegaard and Pogacar, probably the doping issue and the doping concerns, took second fiddle this time. Still, probably the fastest tour ever. So we are still the domination, by one team, unprecedented since probably 1984. So there are probably grounds for the sceptics to say, to raise their eyebrows. And in any case, yeah, it's strange. I mean, it we had to wait for the final press conference for Kate Wagner to ask the question I would have asked as well, which is not so much about trying to find out whether Jumbo-Visma, do doping or not. I mean, the answers are always the same. Not at all. We train hard. We have the best equipment. We take marginal gains. We take attention to all the little details, the nutrition, and all these sort of arguments that are the question in this case is why all of a sudden has doping kind of disappeared from sight. So is it a good news? Is it bad news? I don't have the answer to that, but there we are.
Well, yeah, there is very little to go on, and there hasn't been much to go on really since before the lockdown. And the UCI issued some, encouraging statistics about the level of testing that was maintained through the lockdown period, and maintain that testing is going on. There's not really much else to kind of get your teeth into doping-wise. There's the investigation centering on the Bahrain Victorious team. Miguel Angel Lopez of Astana has been questioned by police about a matter that relates to doping, according to the people asking the questions anyway. So I suppose, is it a case with my sort of sceptical hat on that is it possible to be too clean? I don't know. Is it the fact that there is very little noise around the peloton something that in a funny way should raise our suspicion slightly? I mean, I've talked to a few people this week about how much of a level ahead Jumbo-Visma and even Pogacar have been. And there've been the odd raised eyebrow about the level, but just hearing Rod Ellingworth say that Geraint Thomas is better now than he was in 2018. It's a puzzle. It's not one that I can readily get my head around. But like I say, we'll discuss in a bit more detail in Paris and maybe canvas a bit more opinion tomorrow afternoon. Just on your stat about the Renault Elf team in 1984, they actually won 10 of 23 stages, including the team time trial with seven different riders. 1986, La Vie Claire won six stages, as they dominated the tour with Bernardino and Greg LeMond, and I think Nicky Ruterman and Jean-Francois Bernard also won stages. Six stage winners for Jumbo-Visma so far. They could make it seven tomorrow, which, as you say, Francois, would be, I think, the tour record since 1984. But we shall have to see on the Champs-Élysées tomorrow. We should probably wrap things up there because, as I say, we've got to get north to Limoges. The Hippopotamus restaurant does stay open late, but it doesn't stay open beyond 10:30, so we need to get there for that. Just a few things to update people on before we return for our final Tour de France episode tomorrow. Stacey Snyder's Tour de France Femme Cups, cappuccino sets, espresso sets and whiskey cups will go on sale on Monday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. UK time, and that's 4 p.m. Central European Time. Go to Stacey's Etsy store. There's a link to that store on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. You can vote for your Pedaleur de Charme, and the winner will receive a Stacey Snyder Cup. And the four finalists, after much deliberation by the jury, were Magnus Cort, Fred Wright, Jonas Vingegaard and Ugo Uhl. And you can go to our Twitter page, cycling_podcast, to vote for your favourite there. The collection of wine, Le Cru de Flaneur, curated by Greg Andrews, has been flying out of the door from Divine Cellars. If you'd like to enjoy the wine edition of the Tour de France, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and you can buy the case there. our book. Well, Francois, you had a big hand in this book. Olivier Haralambon's book, originally written in French, translated by you, The Cyclist and His Shadow. We're going to talk about that tomorrow in Paris, and we'll put out a little chat about the book as an episode of Kilometre Zero next week. But the book is on sale, thecyclingpodcast.com for that as well. And just before we get to the Tour de Buffalo to round off today's episode, a real honour for us today, because at the British Podcast Awards, the Cycling Podcast was asked to present the Best Sports Podcast Award. And, well, neither Daniel Freeb nor myself were able to be there today, unfortunately, in London for the awards. So we asked our producer and presenter of Service Course, Tom Wally, to present the award on the Cycling Podcast's behalf. We were asked really as a nod to Richard Moore and his contribution to sports podcasting. So very honoured to be at the British Podcast Awards this afternoon. Tom Wally handed the prize to a BBC World Service podcast called The Fake Paralympians. And I think one of the podcasts that Tom produces, The Football Ramble, was runner-up. No nomination for the Cycling Podcast this year, although we were nominated in the first 4 years of the awards, but... we're the Raymond Poulidor of British sports podcasts because we've been on the podium several times, but we've never actually won it. Maybe next year. Anyway, Francois, we need to get to Paris for tomorrow's stage, not just the final stage of the men's race, but also the opening stage of the Tour de France Femme. Daily coverage of that coming from, well, Monday, really, with Rose Manley. We'll recap tomorrow's stage within the regular episode of the Cycling Podcast as the race kicks off. But this is the Tour de Buffalo, and this, Francois, is from last year in Paris, when you were sitting down for dinner, I think, and saw Geraint Thomas walking up the street after the finish of the Tour de France with his wheelie suitcase, and Richard, being Richard, flagged him down and recorded a conversation for the podcast.
The Tour du Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
So I'm happy to have been teammates with him.
That was Chris Yule Jensen, and we're in the right place here, guys, because look who's coming down the street. It's Wout Poels still in his cycling kit. And Geraint Thomas pushing a pram. Geraint, how are you?
Yeah, I've been better. It's nice to finish though and first race with the boy here, so yeah.
Well, your family's here. You're pushing a buggy from Tour de France rider to, well, hello. Is this the first time they've been at the race or?
Yeah, well, they came to the TT at the Worlds last year, but that was a bit abnormal as well. So first proper race. So yeah, it's been nice to have him here, but switch off for 12 hours and on the plane to Tokyo. So
when do you leave?
Tomorrow night.
So you've not had an ideal tour, obviously pretty bashed up from the start, but how do you come out of it? How do you feel?
I actually feel okay for coming out of the tour. Just rest up now and then just give it everything on Saturday and we see what happens really. And then the TT is probably a better, well, you know, I'll have longer to acclimatise for that. It's Wednesday obviously, so a week Wednesday. But yeah, we'll see how it goes, but I'm looking forward to it, you know, a bit of a change of scenery as well, different, you know, with GB and stuff, it's different to the team, obviously, so, yeah.
And in the team, happy, you've got someone on the podium, Billy, I believe he's known as, yeah. But, you know, that's a success, I guess.
Yeah, of course, this is the first time, you know, an Ecuadorian guy's been on the podium, so, you know, that's good in itself. And then, you know, I think we're just obviously, when you've won it seven times, anything but winning is seen as disappointment, isn't it, really? And, you know, we didn't win a stage, but we got Billy on the podium. So I think it's still, you know, we can be happy and proud of what we did, you know. It was just, it was a crazy tour, as everyone knows, you know. It was totally different to normal. Like, so even UAE didn't seem too keen to even ride on the Champs-Élysées, which was crazy, you know. I thought, you know, make the most of it. Like, you know, it was a few laps of honours, you know, but... Anyway, it's just, it's different, but go again next year, don't we?
Pogacar beatable?
No one's unbeatable, but he's certainly pretty talented and pretty good. But, you know, I think, well, if I hadn't have, you know, slapped off and if Richie hadn't as well, and well, at least we would have had a few more guys up there and could have done something different. Whether that would have cracked him, I probably doubt it this tour, but who knows? You know, next year's a different... Every race you start from scratch, don't you? So
you're good at podcasting, so you know.
I've always, you know, I've got stuff to fall back on, you know. So you know, you got to broaden
your skill base.
That's the one, yeah, yeah. More strings to your bow and all that. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Good luck in Tokyo.
One last question for Geraint. Is it gonna be a fourth season of Gavin Stace?
It should be Stacey. Oh. Not Stace, mate. Come on.
Gotta be.
Yeah. No hope. Well, it's a quality show, that, isn't it?
Quality, yeah.
And Twin Town. You seen Twin Town?
No.
You gotta watch that. That's okay. A cracking movie.
Great.
Yeah.
Nice. Thanks, Geraint.
Cheers.
We must get to Paris, Francois.
Let's go.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.